Good morning, this is AM, I'm Tim Palmer. The Prime Minister Julia Gillard's kicked off her five-day visit to Western Sydney, telling the Labor faithful that the region's citizens shouldn't be regarded as second rate and deserve a fairer share from what they earn. During a keynote speech last night, Ms Gillard told the audience that her experience representing the people of Melbourne's West means she understands firsthand Western Sydney's yearning for respect and recognition. Chief Political Correspondent Sabra Lane was at last night's address and joins me now. Sabra, the speech was all about this five-point plan. What is it and how will it go down out there?
Tim, it's all about Australian jobs first, the high-speed broadband for this area, world-leading education, the National Disability Insurance Scheme, and of course the Prime Minister also talked about helping to manage the pressures of modern-day family life. Linked in with that today, she's already announced that the federal government's prepared to make a down payment of $1 billion for the WestConnex M4 motorway link here in Sydney. This is a link that's missing from Strathfield in the city's west to the city, but she's made it conditional on a couple of things: that the existing tollway remains toll-free, that there's a link to Port Botany to get freight trucks off the system and out of the way, and also that there is a tunnel to the CBD. So that sort of thing is likely to play out quite well in here in Sydney's west, where congestion is a major issue.
It certainly is. Now, away from the policy, the preparation for this whole event has had so much attention and analysis over a week, it appear there's a certain amount of cynicism's already taken root. Was it the right strategy?
Look, it wasn't originally the government's plan for the news of the visit to be out known so well ahead of time. It was nearly a week before she got here that news leaked, and it wasn't the government's intention. So that's why there is a bit of cynicism about it. But here this morning, there are a number of TV programs broadcasting around the hotel where the Prime Minister's been staying. Right out front, the entrance, Tony Abbott has just made an appearance in one of those programs here, and the Prime Minister's driven off for another. But last night, certainly the party faithful seemed to lap up her message, and warming up the crowd was the New South Wales State Secretary, Sam Dastyari.
We all know we're in a difficult fight right now, and there are people lining up to kick us. And we can be honest with each other enough to say that sometimes some of those kicks are deserved when it comes to things like the ICAC inquiry happening in Sydney. When people in our party, when people in the Great Australian Labor Party let down New South Wales, frankly, they deserve whatever punishment comes their way.
Western Sydney is home to five marginal Labor seats. Another five normally considered safe may suffer double-digit swings come September 14, if recent opinion polling results are any guide. The region's home to two former Labor Prime Ministers, Gough Whitlam and Paul Keating, and the incumbent hopes her ties with Melbourne's West will endear her here too.
Being from the West should never be viewed as second rate. In this region, your fierce sense of pride in your home and its achievements should engender recognition and respect.
Ms Gillard says the government's boosted health funding to the region and supported jobs after the global financial crisis, and that it wouldn't miss out with the National Broadband Network, Gonski Education Reforms or the National Disability Insurance Scheme.
I want to make sure that areas like Sydney's West and the people who live and work here get a fairer share of what you create. Put simply, we do not accept that other suburbs come first and you come second.
The Prime Minister also touched on the new National Anti-Gun Task Force she announced earlier in the day. It will receive $64 million in funding over 4 years to tackle gangs, imported illegal guns and organised crime.
I make no apology for saying this is vital business. Not when a nine-year-old boy in Bankstown can find bullet casings fired into the bedroom he shares with his mother and three other children. Not when the industrial estates in my own community in Melbourne's West have become bikey battlegrounds.
The electoral battleground for now is Western Sydney, and last night the party faithful at least lapped it up.
Okay, kisses all round.
Kisses all round indeed. Labor Party supporters at the University of Western Sydney. Ending that report by Chief Political Correspondent Sabra Lane. United Nations human rights monitors have raised serious concerns about the federal government's cuts to single-parent welfare. The UN warns that the cuts could be contrary to Australia's international human rights obligations. Welfare groups say the warnings from the UN should embarrass the federal government. Social affairs reporter Sally Sara has this exclusive report.
Kerry Arch is a single mother from Julia Gillard's electorate of Lay Law. She's glad that experts from the UN Human Rights Council are raising concerns about cuts to single-parent welfare payments.
The United Nations, if they could help us to reverse this, it would be much appreciated. And it's nice to know that we do have organisations, worldwide organisations, to help us as well.
Ms Arch says she's $100 a week worse off because of the Prime Minister's welfare changes.
It's just a disgrace, and I can't believe that she's doing this, and I can't believe that the UN even has to step in to help us.
The UN Special Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty and Human Rights and the Working Group on Discrimination Against Women want answers from the federal government. They warn that a reduction in welfare payments to single parents could have a detrimental effect on the human rights of up to 100,000 Australians. Chief Executive Officer of the Australian Council of Social Service, Cassandra Goldie, says Australian welfare groups took their case to the UN in October last year after exhausting all options in Australia.
So we felt we now had nowhere to go. There was no court that we could go to in Australia. And so we went to the United Nations to raise our concerns.
The Federal Parliament's own Human Rights Committee recommended that the government delay its proposed changes to single-parent payments. But Cassandra Goldie from ACOS says the government went ahead anyway.
And now we have the United Nations Special Rapporteur also asking the government to account for what it's doing.
The UN monitors warned that the welfare cuts could be contrary to some of Australia's international obligations. Beth Goldblatt from the Australian Human Rights Centre says it's a wake-up call for the federal government.
The government should take it seriously. They should be aware that it will be embarrassing, and they should rethink the decision they've made around parenting payment in terms of their international human rights obligations.
The UN monitors say they don't wish to prejudge the accuracy of the allegations against the federal government, but they have publicly released their letter after waiting for more than 4 months to receive a reply. The federal government says it's still considering the matters raised by the UN Special Rapporteur and will respond shortly.
Social affairs reporter Sally Sara. You're listening to AM Around Australia, where it's 17 minutes past seven. The Afghan president, Hamid Karzai, condemned the killing of two young boys in a military operation that involved Australian forces in Uruzgan province. The brothers, both under 7 years old, were shot dead from a helicopter after being mistaken for Taliban fighters. South Asia correspondent Michael Edwards reports.
The two boys were tending livestock and collecting firewood in the southern province of Uruzgan when they were killed. Australian troops were involved in an operation in the area, but it's widely believed the fatal shots were fired by a US military helicopter. The International Security Assistance Force has apologised to the families of the boys killed. The ISAF spokesman is Brigadier General Gunter Gatz.
It is with deep regrets that ISAF has to inform that our forces were responsible for the unintended death of two young Afghans during an operation on the 28th of February in Uruzgan province.
Australia's Defence Chief General David Hurley also acknowledges that ISAF troops are responsible for the deaths, but he says it's premature to say exactly who is to blame. General Hurley has confirmed, though, that Australian Special Forces soldiers were on the ground conducting a patrol when the incident took place. The Afghan president, Hamid Karzai, says the deaths are further proof that the war on the Taliban shouldn't be fought in the country's villages. Kabul-based analyst Heather Barr from Human Rights Watch says civilian deaths are an increasing source of tension between Afghanistan and its Western allies.
Well, we've seen over the last couple of years this relationship becoming increasingly tense. And we've seen it punctuated by frequent sort of almost tantrums by Karzai. And these are very often prompted by civilian casualties. And we've seen Karzai responding with specific measures, including his recent ban on Afghan security forces calling in airstrikes. And then, of course, we've had the events of the last week or so where Karzai has actually expelled special operations forces from Wardak, a key province near Kabul.
Heather Barr says President Karzai makes no secret of his view that the withdrawal of Western forces will actually improve the security situation.
Karzai's position lately seems to be that the fewer international forces are here, the better the security situation will be. Obviously, ISAF would differ on that assessment of the situation. I think if you look at the WARDAC situation specifically, I think there are really a range of different opinions within WARDAC about whether the departure of special operations forces is going to improve the security or whether it's actually going to jeopardize security in the province.
Australian troops, along with most other Western forces, are set to withdraw from Afghanistan in 2014. This is Michael Edwards reporting for AM.
Australia may have always been a land of drought and flooding rains, but scientists say the nation's now experiencing a climate on steroids. The summer just passed was the hottest recorded, and a new report by the Climate Commission says the influence of climate change on that weather is now clear. Here's environment reporter Sarah Clark.
While southeast Queensland floods once again, New South Wales is cleaning up after heavy rainfall dumped in parts of the state. As well as the wet weather, there have been devastating bushfires in at least three states, heat waves, and the hottest summer on record.
Look, it's been a summer of extremes. It's been a very angry summer.
Professor Tim Flannery is from the Climate Commission, and today it released a new report which says the recent wild weather is linked to climate change and has been made worse as a result. Professor Will Steffen is the author of the report. He says it's indicative of a trend that shows an increase in extreme weather events.
In Australia, over the last 50 years, we've seen a doubling of the record hot days. We're getting twice as much record hot weather now than we did in the mid-20th century. We're getting less cold weather. In fact, if we look at the last decade, we're getting three times as many record hot days as we are record cold days. So the statistics are telling us, too, that there is an influence on extreme events. They're shifting.
Shifting and being made worse, according to this report. It states that temperature records were set in every state and territory over summer, and since mid-last year, much of Australia has been drier than usual. While Queensland and New South Wales copped heavy rainfall, Victoria and South Australia recorded their driest summer in decades. Tim Flannery's from the Climate Commission.
I think one of the best ways of thinking about it is imagining that the baseline has shifted. So, you know, if an athlete takes steroids, for example, you know, by analogy, their baseline shifts. They'll do fewer slow times and many more record-breaking fast times. The same thing's happening with our climate system. As it warms up, we're getting fewer cold days and cold events and many, many more record hot events. So it is, in effect, it's a climate on steroids is what we're seeing.
So what can the future deliver? Well, this report says expect more of the summers just gone. And with this trend likely to continue, Tim Flannery says there's an increasing cost to the community. It's a warning that's been made before, but he says it's now time it's taken seriously.
Look, I think we're seeing a real sense of exhaustion in some parts of the community. You know, flood-prone areas of Queensland being one example of that. And we're seeing the actual costs now of inaction, of global inaction to deal with this problem. We are going to be responsible for how fast we move, but from a scientific perspective and looking at the way our climate system is responding, you'd have to say that swift, decisive action this decade is the best course of action we could take.
Professor Tim Flannery. Around half of all Australians who take up an apprenticeship don't finish their training, and unions believe that's often because of the low wages. The Fair Work Commission will today begin hearing a case to determine the appropriate award rate for apprentices, juniors and trainees. The federal government agrees with the unions that apprentices should be paid more, but not surprisingly, employer groups are opposing the case. From Canberra, Naomi Woodley reports.
In Australia, apprentices under the age of 20 are paid a percentage of the award rate for their trade. For some first-year trainees, that's as little as $265 per week. The national president of the Australian Manufacturing Workers Union, Andrew Detmar, says it's close to criminal.
48% of apprentices drop out of their apprenticeship, most in the first and second year. And even though some go back later to finish off their apprenticeship, that is still a huge expense on the economy. But it's also a huge expense on those employers who have gone to the trouble of employing an apprentice.
Unions are asking the Fair Work Commission to bring wages up to 60% of the standard trade rate across the board, giving young apprentices a weekly wage of $423 and older trainees the minimum award rate for their job. Andrew Detmar says modern awards should take into account that apprentices themselves have changed.
Because they're now 19 and 20-year-olds as opposed to the 14 and 15-year-olds, they've got all of the demands placed upon them, young adults as they are. You know, it could be a car, it could be a housing loan. In some instances, many young people have dependent children, and some of them have dependent spouses.
The federal government's submission supports those arguments. It says there's a strong case for an increase in apprenticeship wages, but doesn't specify an amount. It also cautions that any increase should be balanced against the ability of employers to pay. The Australian Industry Group argues the increase being sought by the unions is simply too high.
There's a lot of sympathy for the notion that apprentices could and should be paid more. Most already are paid over the award rate. To push for this sort of increase with these sort of onerous conditions that they're asking employers or suggesting that employers should be compelled to take up would quite simply mean that in many cases employers wouldn't take on apprentices, and that's in nobody's interest.
The chief executive of the Australian Industry Group, Innes Willocks, says moving from a rigid timetable for apprenticeships to a more flexible model based on achieving competency is a better way to encourage more to finish their training. That's also supported in the government submission. The hearing is likely to run for several weeks, and the commission will make a determination later this year.
Naomi Woodley reporting. Commuters in Sydney and Melbourne may have found they had a little more elbow room this morning. In what's more of a survival strategy than a cosmetic overhaul, the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age hit the streets today in a new tabloid format. The larger broadsheet layout's been dumped for weekend editions as Fairfax Media fights to hold on to readers and advertisers in a digital media world that's forced the closure of papers around the globe. Here's AM's business editor, Peter Ryan.
The page of history has turned at The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald, and what you're hearing is the sound of a more user-friendly tabloid format that Fairfax Media prefers to call compact. Apart from the size and an updated font, one of the biggest changes puts sport onto the back page. And in a newspaper first, brain imaging research was used to track what readers really want, according to Fairfax's head of advertising strategy, Sarah Keith.
There was a concern that you think, well, maybe you're using the left brain, you know, some more detailed side of the brain when you read a broadsheet, but maybe with compact you're just sort of skimming over things. Actually, what we discovered is that the brain was in a very, very balanced state when reading the compact, which was great news, which from my point of view, when I'm going out to talk to advertisers, are saying, look, actually, your ads are going to be more engaging in this product.
A former editor of The Age, Mike Smith, says the long-resisted switch is now a matter of survival, with the rivers of gold from classified advertising now a trickle.
Well, this is the most significant physical change to the Fairfax papers since they took ads off the front page, and it took a world war to do that, and it's taken a threat to their very existence to make them go tabloid.
Mike Smith agrees Fairfax's biggest challenge is protecting the values of the old broadsheet brand, such as quality and high editorial standards.
There are already some people who say that the Fairfax papers are tabloid papers in broadsheet clothing, and they've been very careful in their marketing of these papers that are coming out to try and protect the brand and persuade and convince people that nothing is happening to the journalism, just the size.
The former editor-in-chief of the Sydney Morning Herald, Peter Frey, who was ousted last year as part of Fairfax's restructure, says if the tabloid switch doesn't work, weekday printed editions of The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald might soon disappear.
If you can deliver what audiences want in any form, in any channel, then you may have a future. My gut feeling is that we may not see a printed Monday to Friday in, say, 5 years. Some people say it's much sooner than that, 1 to 2 years.
Today's changes are just the start. Next comes the digital paywall later this year and the closure of printing presses in Sydney and Melbourne, which will see The Age and The Herald published at less expensive regional sites.
Business editor Peter Ryan reporting. And you'll be able to find interviews with the former Fairfax editors Peter Frey and Mike Smith on the AM website later this morning. To the financial markets, and the Dow Jones is trading up 35 points, the Nasdaq up 10 points. In London, the FT100 closed up 18 points. The dollar's buying 102.01 US cents. Spot gold's trading at $1,576.23. I'm Tim Palmer. That's AM for today.